Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the fiscal cliff that was supposed to encourage a big grand bargain wound up producing a much smaller deal on taxes. The headlines say the rich will pay more, the first time in a long time that Congress has voted to make that happen. But is that the whole story? We'll talk to Bob McIntyre from Citizens for Tax Justice about that. Also on Counterspin today, what happened to local commercial radio as a place to hear local bands or learn about local events? That's the question engaged by a new film called Corporate FM. Part murder mystery, part love letter to the key community resource that local radio used to be. And of course, also a tool for activists resisting the corporate consolidation that's really only enriching a few big players. We'll hear from filmmaker Kevin McKinney about Corporate FM. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
One of the biggest issues in the coverage of the slow march towards the so-called fiscal cliff was whether to let the Bush tax cuts expire for the top 2%, an income cutoff of around $250,000 for a couple. On Meet the Press on December 30th, NBC veteran Tom Brokaw made the case that that only sounds like a lot of money.
A lot of people don't realize that in the large urban and suburban areas of America, $250,000 doesn't make you rich. You got two kids in college at $60,000. If you're a boomer, you may have a dependent parent of some kind you're spending another $20,000-$25,000 on. So we have to have the definition of what is the middle class.
Well, okay. A lot of people would probably welcome the opportunity to struggle to get by on a mere $250,000. There's a notion among some pundits that people in big cities like New York make that kind of money. But actually, very few New Yorkers make $250,000, at most about 6% of households. And of course, an increase in the marginal tax rate at that level means you'd pay additional taxes only on your income above that amount. So Tom Brokaw's middle-class wealthy family would be just fine.
That wasn't Tom Brokaw's only problem with how the cliff deal was playing out. He wanted to see Barack Obama do more to cut Social Security and Medicare benefits. As Brokaw put it, Obama, quote, could help himself a lot if he were tougher on the AARP, close quote. He went on to cite the usual talking points about how people are living longer so we can raise the retirement age. To Brokaw, Obama should be working hard to sell this idea to the public after winning the election. That's an odd notion for sure, to push through policies that most people don't want as a way of thanking them for their votes. It's not as if Obama hasn't brought up reducing Social Security benefits. But Brokaw's not alone in champing at the bit for cuts in programs that help people. Washington Post columnist David Ignatius wrote a column on January 3rd lamenting the fact that Obama failed to come up with, quote, a real strategy for cutting the deficit and the entitlement programs that drive it, close quote. And that would be perhaps the zillionth time a pundit has declared, falsely, that Social Security is part of the deficit problem, and that therefore the responsible thing to do is to cut people's benefits. No matter how often inflicting unnecessary pain on those who can least afford it is presented as the view of sensible centrists and middle-of-the-road journalists, it remains a very radical proposition.
It isn't that media don't believe there might be victims of the fiscal cliff-related changes. They just appear to define the term differently. In a December 28th segment, for example, CBS Evening News showcased the fears faced by people who have inherited land worth millions of dollars. A Napa Valley vineyard owner, it seems, has 120 acres. But in 1972, he sold land to pay estate taxes after his grandfather's death. This was when, viewers learn, estate taxes were at an all-time high of 77%. So what's relevant about this? Well, the couple who inherited the land's plans to hand it over to their children would be ruined if the estate tax rose from 35% to 55% on estates worth over $1 million. It's one thing to focus attention on a tax paid by a tiny sliver of the population. 0.29% of estates would face any tax at all in 2013, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. But having made that choice, CBS might have tipped to viewers that there was never a chance the estate tax was going to go to 55% with a $1 million exemption, since not even Democrats were pushing for anything like that. Or that the estate tax has been falling since 2001. And, even more important, the amount exempted from the tax has increased. As of last year, it's $5 million a person, an amount that is, by the way, indexed for inflation, so it will rise over time, unlike, say, the minimum wage that many non-vineyard owners get by on.
The New York Times headline December 21st was vivid. Syria unleashes cluster bombs on town, punishing civilians. Right from the top, then, the piece emphasized what many have long argued, that cluster munitions are unacceptably dangerous to non-combatants, as they are, as reporter C.J. Chivers noted, quote, impossible to use precisely, close quote. Recounting the screams and desperate gatherings of the Syrian town civilians as bombs fell on their homes, the piece makes you wonder who would use such weapons. And a careful reader would note the sentence explaining, quote, the use of cluster munitions is banned by much of the world, although Syria, like the United States, is not party to that international convention, close quote. And that's how it seems to work. The paper's accounts of cluster bombs used by designated enemies can be direct and vivid. Gaddafi is using cluster bombs in civilian area, was a page one headline in April 2011 over a piece that talked about bits of human flesh blasted against a cinder block wall. And then, farther down, in passing, quote, the United States has used cluster munitions itself in battlefield situations in Afghanistan and Iraq and in a strike on suspected militants in Yemen in 2009, close quote. Well, that Yemen strike, which killed 14 women and 21 children, part of the U.S.'s secret drone war in that country, was under and misreported in the U.S., but Yemeni journalist Abdulela Haider Shaya provided crucial on-the-ground reporting. Today, Shaya is in Yemeni prison on what human rights groups call dubious terrorism charges. Efforts at a pardon were thwarted by Barack Obama personally, in a phone call expressing concern at the reporter's release.
And finally, Current TV has been sold to Al Jazeera, which reportedly has plans to launch an American channel sometime in the near future. What happens to Current's on-air hosts is, as of now, unclear, as are the distribution arrangements it has with cable providers. One major carrier, Time Warner in New York, promptly dropped Current from its lineup. The logic of the deal seems to be that Al Jazeera can finally find a way onto American cable television. Al Jazeera has tried, mostly without luck, to get cable operators to carry its English language channel. It does seem like when big news like the beginnings of the Arab Spring is breaking, Americans start tuning in to Al Jazeera English's website. So why can't you just watch Al Jazeera English the same way you might watch MSNBC or CNN or Fox News? Because cable operators don't want you to do that. When asked, they usually say it's a matter of too little space and too many channels. But it's hard not to conclude that perceptions about the political slant of Al Jazeera are a bigger problem than finding space on the dial. After all, most cable subscribers get a steady stream of news and commentary with a distinct point of view. Cable providers just want to ensure that viewers aren't exposed to the wrong point of view.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. I'll give subscription information later on in the show.
The fiscal cliff was an invention of Washington politics, concocted in order to force lawmakers to adopt some combination of tax increases and spending cuts in the name of debt reduction. In the end, what the cliff produced was a tax deal that, according to the headlines, saved middle-class taxpayers from a big hit and stuck the wealthy with an income tax hike. But is that all that happened? With us to talk about the deal and what we weren't hearing about is Bob McIntyre. He is the director of Citizens for Tax Justice. Bob, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thank you.
Now, one of the main messages you get from the discussion of this tax deal is that it's, in fact, a big tax increase on wealthy Americans. The Wall Street Journal had a headline, "High Earners Facing First Major Tax Increase in Years." David Leonard at the New York Times is stressing that the tax bite that will hit the wealthy is significant, and he argues that this is going a long way toward making the tax system more progressive. Is that the right way to look at this deal?
Well, there's more than one way, obviously, or we wouldn't be hearing different ways of looking at it. The chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, before the vote in the House, said it was the biggest tax cut in the history of the world. He's right, because current law would have all the Bush tax cuts expire. But if you want to say, well, compared to what the rich paid last year, they're going to pay more this year and then the following years, well, that's true too. But that's because the Bush tax cuts would have expired for them in any event. Now, so, I mean, I think current law is the right measure, and that if you want to say that this is a big tax cut, I think that the Republicans were right. And as for the rich, well, they got a much more gentle treatment from the final deal than even President Obama was asking, and he just wanted to, you know, make the cutoff that for income above $250,000 or so, you would go back to the Clinton-era tax rates. And now it's above $450,000. So that first $450,000 is still eligible for the Bush tax cuts, and that means a pretty significant tax cut by most ordinary measures, even for wealthy people.
You mentioned where the top rate was going to be set. It seemed like a lot of time was spent on arguing where to set the income threshold. Is it $250,000? Is it $400,000? Is that even a lot of money? Does that much focus on one aspect make much sense to you?
Well, you know, the original Obama plan, which I don't think went far enough to try to get our fiscal house in order, but said that the top 2% of Americans would pay higher taxes than they used to. Or in other words, they would lose their Bush tax cuts. They'd be allowed to expire. Now we're down to less than 1% of the population who will face higher taxes than they used to. They'll lose some, not all, but some of their Bush tax cuts.
Now we're starting to read several days after the congressional vote about a variety of corporate tax breaks and extenders and so on, things that don't seem to have anything to do with avoiding a cliff, but I'm sure are a priority for corporations that are looking to lighten their tax burden.
Well, these so-called business extenders are a collection of obviously useless tax breaks that businesses find very helpful to them in the sense of lowering their taxes. Now, I say obviously useless. I can prove that because the bill that just passed at a cost of more than $90 billion over the next 2 years is retroactive. So all these so-called incentives apply to things people did last year in 2012. Now, how can you give somebody an incentive to do something they already did? I don't know. I mean, maybe it's magic, but other than that, it just makes it clear that what Congress is doing is General Electric came in and said, we would prefer not to pay taxes on our offshore financing income. And Congress said, oh, well, what are you going to do for us? And they did what they did. And they got the tax break. And the reason why these are extenders, as they're so-called, and reenacted every year or two, is that if Congress passed them all permanently, well, then Congress wouldn't get paid every year or two for reenacting them. So they are about as crass a collection of tax breaks as you could possibly imagine. And their cost over the next 2 years will be bigger than what Obama purportedly raises from getting more money out of the rich.
We had, for a couple of weeks there, this big CEO-backed PR campaign to fix the debt. CEOs going on TV talking about getting a handle on our debt problem. Now, a cynic might look at this outcome and wonder if perhaps they were lobbying for something else entirely, something closer to their own interests and bottom line.
Well, here's what the big business position is and these front groups that they have, like Fix the Debt. It is cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and cut corporate taxes. That's their plan to deal with the long-term budget deficit. So So on the one hand, they want to take money away from seniors and low-income people and people that need medical care. And on the other hand, to increase the deficit, they want lower corporate taxes. So aren't they nice that they're so interested in fixing the budget deficit as long as they end up not only not paying to help do that, but in fact getting a tax break?
There seems to be a priority among a lot of pundits on reaching a deal for the sake of deal-making. Both sides compromise, there's bipartisanship, all of that. The actual policy decisions seem to matter a whole lot less. When it comes to tax policy, what kind of outcomes do we get when there's this kind of pressure to make any kind of deal?
Well, I mean, anything can happen in different situations, but the situation here was one side says, I want to raise taxes on 2% of Americans. The other side says, no, we don't want to raise them on anybody. So they compromise, and they raise it on 1%. Well, if one side, I mean, that's just sort of ridiculous. You know, if one side's position is, we don't care, go over the fiscal cliff if you touch our rich people at all, and then you finally compromise, well, we touch them a little, we end up where we are.
And finally, were there ideas or policy proposals that were basically off the table in all of this, ideas that could have been or should have been part of this conversation?
Well, the one thing that hasn't been on the table, and really not from either side, although except slightly from Obama, is our corporate taxes are at ridiculously low levels now, lowest that, on a sustained basis that they've been in 50 years. And yet we don't see the Congress or the president saying, well, gee, you know, one way we can address the budget deficit is to go after some of these companies that are paying nothing at all in taxes and say, you know, you ought to pay a reasonable amount for all the benefits you get for being in America. And it's there's so much money there. I mean, if we got corporate taxes back up to where they were, even in the Clinton years, you could pick up another $100 billion or $200 billion a year, depending on how you did it. Just closing one tax break for companies that ship their profits overseas, you could pick up $1 trillion over a decade. So tons of money there, and doing it in ways that don't necessarily raise the corporate tax rate. In fact, we wouldn't have to, but get rid of loopholes that actually cause positive harm.
Bob McIntyre is director of Citizens for Tax Justice. Find out more about them at ctj.org. Bob McIntyre, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Bye-bye.
Some Counterspin listeners may never have experienced truly local commercial radio, a station that was in your town and acted like it, reporting local news, introducing you to local bands, and promoting local causes and institutions. To those of us that did or do have such a station, that seems a real loss, even as we appreciate and admire the community, college, and internet stations that we have. A new film called Corporate FM illustrates the impact of the loss of local commercial radio and explains what and who are responsible for it. Turns out it's nothing to do with public disinterest and everything to do with folks like Bain Capital. Joining us now by phone from Kansas City, Missouri, is filmmaker Kevin McKinney. He's director and co-producer of Corporate FM. Welcome to Counterspin, Kevin McKinney.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
This show usually talks about the importance of local radio as a news issue, and the film does that too. But a lot of the film is about music, and for many of us, that's where local radio has gone in a fairly short space of time from being the place where you go to hear new music to a place you avoid at all costs. Would you talk a little bit about the impact of ownership consolidation on music in particular?
The whole reason you listen to radio is because it sparks your interest. There's something in there that maybe speaks to your soul. And when radio doesn't give you something new, there's really no reason to listen to it. It's a commercial radio, that is. Now, public radio will play a new song, but it's not playing it in rotation. So that local band might get an interview on a local community radio station, but they're only heard for that, you know, that 1 hour. And then that's it. They don't get the rotation to where the entire population begins to know the words to that song. the whole community isn't dancing to the same song. When we lost commercial radio playing local artists in rotation, that forever changed the local rock band or the local musician's ability to get out and get a critical mass of support behind their music. They still get support. Thank God for the internet, but the internet only gets the dedicated fans who are willing to go out there and look for it.
Yeah, the film makes the point that with local radio, it wasn't just that you were hearing something, but that your neighbors were hearing the same thing at the same time. And I guess that's the piece that internet radio, for example, can't replace. It's true that you can find many great new things, but it's also true that you have to find it in a way.
Right. And this same thing that's happening with music goes across the board. It's part of the decomposition of our civic dialogue is when your neighbor is not getting the same information that you are, say, from NPR or community radio, when they are relying solely on commercial radio or cable news, the lack of diversity is really having a big impact.
The film talks about shrinking the newscasts down to 5 minutes, down to 1 minute, and losing even the capacity for interviews with local or state politicians. But it also talks about the disconnect from the audience at the most fundamental level, where the person you hear when you turn on the station isn't even there. One radio vet talks about taping supposedly live parts of a Sunday morning show on Friday night. What is this phenomenon of voice tracking?
Voice tracking hasn't been really explained well, I think. And I'm so glad that in the movie there was a lot of DJs I talked to and who couldn't talk on the record. And one of them said to me, "You have to expose voice tracking. You have to," because she said it broke her heart when someone would see her in the grocery store, this DJ, and say, "Hey, I heard you on the radio," and she would know what they heard was a shadow of what her show was. And what voice tracking is, and people think it's like, oh, you know, they made a mixtape or something like you would do in high school, making a tape for your girlfriend or boyfriend. But it's actually just building a spreadsheet. They go through, they have all the songs there in a list, and they, okay, I'm going to do an intro for this one, an outro for this one. Throw some commercials in there, intro, outro, station ID. Okay, great. Okay, we just did 4 hours. It's 15 minutes have gone by. We don't need a DJ now. It really takes away the human capacity. We just had New Year's Eve a couple of days ago, and at 8 o'clock here in Kansas City, all the DJs signed off. But you didn't know they signed off. But if you were a teenager and you were at home because your parents wouldn't let you go out and you were listening to the radio wanting to commiserate with the DJ, well, that didn't happen because that DJ recorded the show at 3 p.m. that day and, you know, Happy New Year, not live.
Right, and the Sunday morning show won't mention the big fire that happened Saturday night because it hasn't happened when they record it. And the film shows how, naturally enough, real DJs, real hosts, hate that disconnect from their audience as much as the audience does. But clearly, somebody doesn't hate all of this. Some people think it's all just fine. So let's talk about the industry itself. Some would say the consolidation that we're complaining about is about business competition. But you say that that's not actually the case.
This really is about the disintegration of capitalism. It used to be when you grew something, you grew it in your field and you sold it, and that was your product. In the case of radio, they sold us great programming. They created big audiences, and they sold that to an advertiser. That doesn't happen anymore. Now it's about acquiring as many stations as they can, acquiring the competition as well. Therefore, you know, those stations are stable. They're not going to go anywhere. And then holding on to those stations so they can, you know, buy and sell the station itself as a profit. Now, a private equity firm would also extract maintenance fees from these stations. On top of all that, these firms are lobbing gobs of debt onto these stations. Clear Channel has $6 billion in debt because of Bain Capital. Bain Capital, as you may remember, Mitt Romney's company. Mm-hmm. In order to acquire Clear Channel, they put $6 billion of debt onto Clear Channel, not themselves. This is where the system is also is broken, because the person who's taking the risk isn't the person who's doing the buying.
Well, the movie and the background materials explain the role of private equity, where the acquired company, the station, winds up with all the debt and the leverager takes the profit, but they're not really taking the risk. Well, finally, and I know you're taking the film to theaters, it'll be at Anthology in New York, but you're also using it, aren't you, as an activist tool, because there are things we can do. How are you using this film? What do you hope will come of it?
Sure. There's a lot of things people can do. There are stations that are using the film right now as fundraising efforts. The film also explains something that people who wouldn't care about this issue 10 minutes ago after they see the movie, they're ready to do something. The film also addresses how we need to get money out. All the FCC commissioners, the last four of them, have gone on to serve private equity. So the film actually kind of makes very direct links of, okay, here's a cause, here's effect. So right now, I'm getting this film out.
We've been speaking with filmmaker Kevin McKinney. You can learn more about Corporate FM, how to bring it to your town, and the ideas in it at fmfilm.com. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin, Kevin McKinney.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can go to FAIR's website. It's fair.org. If you sign up now, your subscription starts with Extra's January issue, featuring articles on what was missing from coverage of Hurricane Sandy, including both real on-the-ground reporting and serious discussion of climate change, along with pieces on dark money in the election and media's way of talking about Latino voters while avoiding talking to them. That's all in Extra and more. And FAIR.org is also the place to hear previous episodes of Counterspin, to subscribe to the podcast, or to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.